12. October sunlight hung cold and sparkling. A faint trace of frost still lay over the lawns. It was early morning, and the town of Belmont steamed quietly in a dull cloud of blue-white mist. Along the highway, a steady stream of cars moved up the peninsula toward San Francisco, bumper to bumper.
"Oh, dear,"
Mrs. Pritchett said, distressed.
"All that traffic."
We won't be taking that route, Hamilton told her as he turned the Ford coupe from Bayshore Freeway onto a side road. We're going down toward Los Gatos.
And then what?
Mrs. Pritchett asked, with avid, almost childish expectancy.
Goodness, I've never been over that way.
Then all the way to the ocean, Marcia said, flushed with excitement.
We're going to drive down Highway 1, the Coast Highway, down to Big Sur.
Where's that?
Mrs. Pritchett asked doubtfully.
That's in the Santa Lucia Mountains, just below Monterey. It won't take too long, and it's a lovely place for a picnic.
Fine,
Mrs. Pritchett agreed, settling back against the car seat and folding her hands in her lap.
It certainly is sweet of you to suggest a picnic.
Not at all, Hamilton said, giving the coupe a vicious spurt of gas. I don't see what's wrong with Golden Gate Park, McFife said suspiciously.
Too many people,
Miss Rice said logically.
Big Sur is part of a federal reserve. It's still wild.
Mrs. Pritchett looked apprehensive.
Will we be safe?
Absolutely,
Miss Rice assured her.
Nothing will go wrong.
Shouldn't you be at work, Mr. Hamilton?
Mrs. Pritchett asked.
This isn't a holiday, is it? Mr. Laws is at work.
I took the morning off, Hamilton said sardonically, so I could pilot you around.
Why, how sweet!
Mrs. Pritchett exclaimed, her pulpy hands fluttering on her lap. Puffing moodily on his cigar, McFife said,
What's going on, Hamilton? You trying to put something over on somebody?
A tendril of sickening cigar smoke drifted to the back seat where Mrs. Pritchett sat. Frowning, she abolished cigars. McFife found himself clutching empty air. For an instant, his face turned beet red, then gradually, the color faded.
Ugh,
he muttered.
What were you saying?
Mrs. Pritchett urged. McFife failed to answer. He was clumsily searching his pockets, hoping that by some miracle one cigar had been overlooked.
Mrs. Pritchett, Hamilton said casually, has it ever occurred to you that the Irish have made no contribution to culture? There are no Irish painters, no Irish musicians.
Jesus God,
McFife said, stricken.
No musicians?
Mrs. Pritchett asked in surprise.
Dear, dear, is that so? No, I hadn't realized that.
The Irish are a barbaric race, Hamilton continued, with sadistic pleasure. All they do is... George Bernard Shaw!
McFife howled fearfully.
The greatest playwright in the world, William Butler Yeats, the greatest poet, James Joyce, the...
He broke off quickly.
Also a poet.
Author of Ulysses, Hamilton added. Banned for years because of its lewd and vulgar passages.
It's great art,
McFife croaked. Mrs. Pritchett reflected.
Yes,
she agreed finally, her decision made.
That judge decided it was art. No, Mr. Hamilton, I think you're quite wrong. The Irish have been very talented in the theater and in poetry.
Swift,
McFife whispered encouragingly.
Wrote Gulliver's Travels. Sensational work.
All right, Hamilton agreed amiably. I lose. Almost unconscious with terror, McFife lay gasping and perspiring, his face a mottled gray.
How could you?
Marcia said accusingly, lips close to her husband's ear.
You beast!
Amused, Miss Rice contemplated Hamilton with new respect.
You came close.
As close as I wanted to,
Hamilton answered, a little shocked at himself, now that he thought it over.
Sorry, Charlie. Forget it. McFife muttered hoarsely. To the right of the road lay an expanse of barren fields. As he drove, Hamilton searched his mind. Hadn't something been here? Finally, after considerable effort, he recalled. This was supposed to be a roaring, hammering industrial section of factories and refining plants. Ink, tallow, chemicals, plastics, lumber. Now it was gone. Only the open countryside remained.
"I was by here once before," Mrs. Pritchett said, seeing the expression on his face. "I abolished all those things. Nasty, bad-smelling, noisy places."
"Then there aren't any more factories?" Hamilton inquired. "Bill Laws must feel disappointed without his soapworks."
"I left soap plants," Mrs. Pritchett said sanctimoniously. "The ones that smell nice, at least."
In a kind of depraved way, Hamilton was almost beginning to enjoy himself. It was so completely faulty, so ramshackle and precarious. With a wave of her hand, Mrs. Pritchett wiped out whole industrial regions the world over. Surely this fantasy couldn't last. Its basic substructure was breaking down, crumbling away. Nobody was born. Nothing was manufactured. Entire vital categories simply didn't exist. Sex and procreation were a morbid condition, known only to the medical profession. This fantasy, of its own innate logic, was tumbling. That gave him an idea. Perhaps he was tugging at the wrong end. Perhaps there was a quicker, easier way to pull the fur off the cat. Only there weren't any cats. At memory of Ninny Numcat, a miserable, baffled fury rose up and choked him. Because the tomcat had accidentally strolled in her way. But at least, cats existed back in the real world. Arthur Sylvester, Ninny Numcat, gnats, ink factories, and Russia still muddled on in the real world. He felt cheered. Ninny wouldn't have liked it here anyhow. Mice and flies and gophers had already been eliminated. And in this distorted existence, there wasn't any back-fence carnality. Look, Hamilton said, as an initial experiment. They had entered a run-down slum highway town. Pool halls, shoeshine parlors, slatternly hotels. "A disgrace," he declared. "I'm outraged." Pool halls, shoeshine parlors, and slatternly hotels ceased to exist. All over the world, more blank spaces opened up in the fabric of reality.
"That's better," Marcia said, a trifle uneasily. "But, Jack, maybe it would be better if, I mean, let Mrs. Pritchett decide for herself."
"I'm trying to help," Hamilton said genially. "After all, I'm helping to bring culture to the masses, too." Miss Rice was not long in catching on.
"Look at that policeman," she observed. "Giving that poor motorist a ticket. How can he do such a thing?"
"I pity that motorist," Hamilton agreed heartily. "Falling into the clutches of that beefy savage, probably another Irishman. They're all that way."
"Well, he looks more like an Italian to me,"
Mrs. Pritchett said critically.
"But don't the police do good, Mr. Hamilton? It was always my impression—"
"The police, yes," Hamilton agreed, "but not the traffic cops. That's different."
"Oh," Mrs. Pritchett said, nodding. "I understand."
Traffic cops, including the one on their left, ceased to exist. Everybody, except McFife, breathed more easily. "Don't blame me," Hamilton said. "Blame Miss Rice."
"Let's abolish Miss Rice," McFife said sullenly.
"Now, Charlie," Hamilton said, grinning, "that isn't a proper humanistic spirit."
"Yes," Mrs. Pritchett agreed severely. "I'm surprised at you, Mr. McFife."
Lapsing into smoldering withdrawal, McFife turned to glare out of the car window.
"Somebody ought to get rid of those marshes," he announced. "They smell to high heaven."
The mudflats ceased to smell. In fact, there were no longer any mudflats there. Instead, a kind of vague depression hung along the edge of the road. Peering at it, Hamilton wondered how far down it went. Probably not more than a few yards. The mudflats hadn't been very deep. Stalking morosely up onto the road came a handful of wild birds, inhabitants of the ex-marshes.
"Say," David Pritchett said, "this is sort of fun."
"Join in," Hamilton said expansively. "What are you tired of?" Speculatively, David said,
"I'm not tired of anything. I want to see all this stuff."
That sobered Hamilton. "You're all right," he told the boy, "and don't let anybody change your mind."
"How can I be a scientist if there's nothing to examine?"
David wanted to know.
"Where am I going to get pond water from my microscope? All the stagnant ponds are gone." "Stagnant ponds," Mrs. Pritchett repeated with an effort. "What is that, David? I'm not sure, and there aren't any more broken bottles lying around in fields,"
David complained resentfully.
"And I can't find any more beetles for my beetle collection. And you took all the snakes, so I can't set out my snake trap. What am I going to do instead of watching them load coal down at the railroad? There isn't any more coal. And I used to go through the Parker Ink Company. Now it's gone. Aren't you going to leave anything?"
"Nice things," his mother said reprovingly. "There'll be all kinds of nice things for you to think about. You don't want to play with dirty, unpleasant things, do you?"
"And,"
David continued vigorously,
"Eleanor Root, the girl who moved in across the street, was going to show me something she had that I didn't have. If I went back out to the garage with her, and I did, and she didn't have it after all. And I don't think much of that."
Scarlet, Mrs. Pritchett struggled for words.
"David Pritchett," she cried, "you're a filthy-minded little pervert. What in the name of heaven is the matter with you? How did you get this way?"
"Got it from his father," Hamilton conjectured. "Bad blood."
"It must be."
Breathing with difficulty, Mrs. Pritchett rushed on.
"He certainly didn't get it from me. David, when I get you home, I'm going to give you the whipping of your life. You won't be able to sit down for a week. Oh, never in all my life have I..."
"Abolish him,"
Miss Rice said philosophically.
"Don't you abolish me!"
David roared belligerently.
"You just better not. That's all I have to say."
"I'll speak to you later,"
his mother snapped, chin up, eyes blazing.
"Right now, I don't have another word to address you, young man."
"Gee whiz,"
David complained, despairing. "I'll talk to you," Hamilton told him.
"I'd prefer it if you wouldn't,"
Mrs. Pritchett said tightly.
"I want him to learn that he can't associate with decent people if he's going to take up filthy ways."
"I have a few filthy ways myself," Hamilton began, but Marcia kicked him on the ankle, and he lapsed into silence.
"If I were you,"
Marcia said thinly,
"I wouldn't boast."
Disturbed and upset, Mrs. Pritchett gazed mutely out the window of the car and systematically abolished various categories. Old farmhouses with tottering windmills ceased to be. Ancient rusty automobiles vanished from this version of the universe. Outhouses disappeared, along with dead trees, shabby barns, rubbish heaps, and poorly dressed itinerant fruit pickers.
"What's that over there?"
Mrs. Pritchett demanded irritably. To their right was a squat, ugly building of concrete.
"That," Hamilton stated, "is a Pacific Gas and Electric Company power station. It relays high voltage cables."
"Well," Mrs. Pritchett conceded, "I suppose that's useful."
"Some people think so," Hamilton said.
"They could make it more attractive,"
Mrs. Pritchett objected. As they passed the building, its plain lines flowed and wavered. By the time they had left it, the power station had become a quaint, tile-roofed cottage with nasturtiums tangled up its pastel walls.
"Lovely,"
Marcia murmured. "Wait until the electricians show up to check the cable," Hamilton said. "They'll be surprised."
"No,"
Miss Rice corrected with a humorless smile.
"They won't notice a thing."
It was not quite noon when Hamilton drove the Ford from Highway 1 into the chaotic green wilderness that was the Los Padres Forest. Massive redwoods towered on all sides of them, Glades of frigid gloom lay forebodingly on either side of the narrow road that led deep into Big Sur Park and up the slope of Cone Peak itself.
"It's scary,"
David pronounced. The road climbed. Presently, they had reached a broad slope of bright bushes and shrubbery, with rocks scattered here and there among the slender evergreens. And Edith Pritchett's favorite flowers, California golden poppies, grew by the millions. Mrs. Pritchett, at the sight, gave a delighted cry.
"Oh, it's so beautiful! Let's have our picnic here!"
Obligingly, Hamilton left the road and drove the Ford out onto the meadow itself. Bump, bump went the car before Mrs. Pritchett had a chance to abolish ruts. A moment later, they came to a halt, and Hamilton turned off the car engine. There was no sound but the faint steaming of the radiator and the echoing cry of birds.
"Well," Hamilton said, "here we are."
They piled eagerly out of the car. The men hauled the baskets of food from the luggage compartment. Marcia carried the blanket and the camera. Miss Rice brought the thermos bottle of hot tea. David, leaping and scampering around, slashed at bushes with a long stick, flushing a whole family of quail.
"How cute," Mrs. Pritchett noticed. "Look at the baby ones go."
No other people were visible. Only the expanse of tumbling green forest leading down to the ribbon of the Pacific Ocean, the endless lead-gray body of unrowed far below, and beyond that, the mighty surface of moving water that awed even David.
"Gosh," he whispered, "it's sure big."
Mrs. Pritchett selected the exact spot for the picnic, and the blanket was scrupulously spread out. Baskets were opened, napkins, paper plates, forks, and cups were passed jovially around. Off in the shadows of the nearby evergreens, Hamilton stood preparing the chloroform. Nobody paid any attention to him as he unfolded his handkerchief and began saturating it. The cool midday wind whipped the fumes away from him. No danger to anybody else. Only one person's nose, mouth, and breathing apparatus were going to be menaced. It would be quick, safe, and effective.
"What are you doing, Jack?"
Marcia said suddenly in his ear. Startled, he leaped guiltily, almost dropping the bottle.
Nothing, he told her shortly. "Go back and start cracking the hard-boiled eggs."
"You're doing something."
Frowning, Marcia peered over his broad shoulder.
"Jack, is that rat poison?"
He grinned shakily.
"Cough medicine, for my catarrh."
Brown eyes large, Marcia said,
"You're going to do something. I can tell. You always have a sort of shifty way when you're up to something."
"I'm going to put an end to this ridiculous business," Hamilton said fatalistically. "I've had all I can stand."
Marcia's firm, sharp fingers closed around his arm.
"Jack, for my sake,
you like it here so much?"
Bitterly, he jerked away from her.
"You and Laws and McFife, having a fine time, wish you were here? While that hag abolishes people and animals and insects, everything her limited imagination fixes itself on?"
"Jack, don't do anything. Please, don't. Promise me."
"Sorry," he told her. "It's all decided. The wheels have started turning."
Peering nearsightedly across the meadow at the two of them, Mrs. Pritchett called,
"Come on, Jack and Marcia! Cold cuts and yogurt! Hurry while there's still some left!"
Blocking his way, Marcia said swiftly,
"I won't let you. You just can't, Jack. Don't you understand? Remember Arthur Sylvester. Remember—"
"Get out of the way,"
he broke in testily.
"This stuff evaporates."
Suddenly, to his amazement, tears filled her eyes.
"Oh, Christ, darling, what'll I do? I couldn't stand it if she abolished you. I'd die."
Hamilton's heart softened.
"You donkey."
"It's true."
Tears rolled helplessly down her cheeks. Clutching at him, she tried to push him back. It was, naturally, a waste of effort. Miss Rice had successfully maneuvered Edith Pritchett around so that her back was to Hamilton. David, talking excitedly, was holding his mother's attention,
waving a curious rock he had excavated and pointing off into the distance at the same time. The situation was set up and waiting. His chance wouldn't come again.
"Go stand over there," Hamilton said gently. "Turn your back if you can't watch."
Firmly, he pried loose her fingers and shoved her away.
"It's for your sake, too. For you, Laws, Ninny, all the rest of us. For the sake of McFife's cigars."
"I love you, Jack,"
Marcia quavered wretchedly.
"And I'm in a hurry," he answered. "Okay?"
She nodded.
"Okay. Good luck."
"Thanks."
As he moved toward the picnic site, he said to her, "I'm glad you've forgiven me about Silky."
"Have you forgiven me?"
"No,"
he said stonily. "But maybe I will when I see her again."
"I hope you do,"
Marcia said pitifully.
"Just keep your fingers crossed."
Striding over the spongy ground, he left her and rapidly made his way toward the sloping, shapeless back of Edith Pritchett. Mrs. Pritchett was in the process of downing a paper cupful of hot orange blossom tea. Gripped in her left hand was half of a hard-boiled egg. On her extensive lap lay a plate of potato salad and stewed apricots. As Hamilton approached and hurriedly bent down, Miss Rice said firmly to the old woman,
"Mrs. Pritchett, would you pass me the sugar?"
"Why, certainly, dear,"
Mrs. Pritchett replied civilly, setting down the remains of her hard-boiled egg and groping intently for the waxed paper bundle that was the sugar.
"Goodness,"
she went on, wrinkling her nose,
"whatever is that distressing odor?"
And, in Hamilton's trembling hands, the chloroform-impregnated cloth faded away. The bottle, pressing against his hip, ceased to trouble him. He'd been relieved of it. Mrs. Pritchett politely placed the sugar bundle in Miss Rice's nerveless hands and returned to her hard-boiled egg. It was over. The strategy had collapsed, quietly and completely.
"Very delicious tea,"
Mrs. Pritchett exclaimed as Marcia came slowly over.
"You're to be congratulated, my dear. You're a natural-born cook."
"Well," Hamilton said, "that's that."
Settling down on the ground, he rubbed his hands briskly together and surveyed the assortment of food.
"What do we have here?"
Wide-eyed, David Pritchett gaped at him.
"The bottle's gone,"
he wailed.
"She took it!"
Ignoring him, Hamilton began collecting a lapful of food.
"I guess I'll have some of everything," he said heartily. "It sure looks good."
"Help yourself,"
Mrs. Pritchett gushed, her mouth stuffed with egg.
"Do try some of this marvelous celery and cream cheese. It's really incredible."
Thanks, Hamilton acknowledged. "I'll do that."
David Pritchett, hysterical with despair, leaped to his feet, pointed his finger at his mother, and shrieked,
"You wicked old frog! You took our chloroform! You made it disappear! Now what'll we do?" "Yes, dear,"
Mrs. Pritchett said matter-of-factly.
"It was a nasty, foul-smelling chemical, and I frankly don't know what you can do. Why don't you finish your meal and then go see how many kinds of ferns you can identify?"
In a funny, strained little voice, Miss Rice said,
"Mrs. Pritchett, what are you going to do with us?"
"Gracious,"
Mrs. Pritchett declared, helping herself to more potato salad.
"What kind of a question is that? Eat your food, dear. You're really too thin. You should have more flesh on your bones."
Mechanically, the group of people ate. Only Mrs. Pritchett seemed to enjoy her meal. She ate with relish, and she ate quite a lot.
"Ah, it's so peaceful up here," she observed. "Only the sound of the wind rustling through the pines."
Off in the distance, a plane buzzed faintly, a Coast Guard patrol craft on its way up the shoreline.
"Dear me,"
Mrs. Pritchett said, her brows drawing pettishly together.
"What an unwelcome intrusion."
The plane, and all other members of the genus plane, ceased to be.
"Well," Hamilton said with mock carelessness, "there goes that. I wonder what's next."
Dampness, Mrs. Pritchett answered emphatically.
I beg your pardon?
Dampness.
Uncomfortably, the woman squirmed around on her cushion.
I can feel the dampness of the ground. It's very annoying.
Can you abolish an abstraction?
Miss Rice inquired.
I can, my dear.
The ground, under the six of them, became as warm and dry as toast.
And the wind, it's a trifle chill, don't you think?
The wind became a glowing caress.
How do you find it now?
A crazed abandon overcame Hamilton. What did he have to lose? There was nothing left. They had reached the end. Isn't that ocean a disgusting color? He announced. I find it offensive. The ocean ceased to be a dull, leaden gray. It became a gay, pastel green.
Much better,
Marcia managed. Sitting close beside her husband, she clutched convulsively at his hand.
Oh, darling,
she began hopelessly. Pulling her close against him, Hamilton said, look at that seagull flapping around out there.
It's looking for fish,
Miss Rice commented. Evil-minded bird, Hamilton declared, killing helpless fish. The gull vanished.
But fish deserve it,
Miss Rice pointed out thoughtfully.
They prey on small water life, simple one-celled protozoa.
Vicious, filthy-minded fish, Hamilton said spiritedly. A faint ripple seemed to stir the water. Fish, as a category, had ceased to exist. In the middle of the picnic cloth, their small wad of smoked herring faded out.
Oh, dear,
Marcia said.
That was imported from Norway.
Must have cost quite a bit, McFife muttered sickly. All that imported stuff costs.
Who wants money? Hamilton demanded. Getting out a handful of change, he scattered it down the hillside. The bits of bright metal lay sparkling in the early afternoon sun. Dirty stuff. The glowing dots vanished. In his pocket, his wallet gave a queer thump. The paper bills had left it.
This is charming,
Mrs. Pritchett giggled.
It's so sweet of you all to help me. I run out of things now and then.
Far down the slope, a cow was visible, making its way slowly along. As they watched, the cow did something unmentionable.
Abolish cows,
Miss Rice cried, but it was unnecessary. Edith Pritchett had already felt displeasure. The cow was gone. And so, Hamilton noted, was his belt, and his wife's shoes, and Miss Rice's purse. All were made from hide, and, on the picnic cloth, the yogurt and cream cheese had left too. Leaning over, Miss Rice tugged at an annoying clump of dry, ragged weeds.
What offensive plants,
she complained.
One of them stuck me.
The weeds vanished. So did most of the dry grass on the fields where the former cows had grazed. Instead, only barren rock and dirt were visible. Racing around in a hysterical circle, David shouted,
I found some poison oak! Poison oak!
The woods are full of it, Hamilton revealed, and nettles, and treacherous vines. To their right, the grove of trees shuddered. All around them, the forest gave a faint, almost invisible twitch. A thinness of vegetation became evident. Gravely, Marcia removed the remnants of her shoes. Only the cloth stitching and the metal staples remained.
Isn't this sad?
She said mournfully to Hamilton.
Banish shoes, Hamilton suggested.
That would be a good idea,
Mrs. Pritchett agreed, bright-eyed with enthusiasm.
Shoes cramp the feet.
The remnants in Marcia's hands disappeared, along with the various shoes of the group. McFife's great loud socks waggled starkly in the sunlight. Embarrassed, he dragged them under him and out of sight. On the horizon, the smoke of an ocean tramp steamer was faintly visible.
Crass commercial freighter, Hamilton stated. Wipe it off the map.
The haze of dark smoke vanished. Commercial shipping had come to an end.
A much cleaner world,
Miss Rice commented. Along the highway, a car moved. Its radio blared up tinnily.
Abolish radios, Hamilton said.
The noise ceased.
And TV sets and movies.
No visible change occurred, but it had been consummated nevertheless.
And cheap musical instruments, accordions and harmonicas and banjos and vibraharps.
All over the world, those instruments were gone.
Advertisements,
Miss Rice cried, as a heavy oval truck moved along the highway, its painted sides gleaming with words. The words disappeared.
Trucks, too.
The truck itself disappeared, hurtling the driver into the drainage ditch at the edge of the pavement.
He's hurt,
Marcia said feebly. The struggling driver was immediately gone.
Gasoline, Hamilton said. That's what the truck was carrying.
All over the world, gasoline vanished.
Oil and turpentine,
Miss Rice added.
Beer, rubbing alcohol, and tea,
Hamilton said.
Pancake syrup, honey, and cider,
Miss Rice said.
Apples, oranges, lemons, apricots, and pears,
Marcia said faintly.
Raisins and peaches,
McFife muttered grumpily.
Nuts, yams, and sweet potatoes,
Hamilton said. Obligingly, Mrs. Pritchett abolished those various categories from the face of the earth. Their cups of tea became empty. The supply of picnic food markedly dwindled.
Eggs and frankfurters,
Miss Rice cried, leaping to her feet.
Cheese, doorknobs, and coat hangers,
Hamilton added, joining her. Giggling, Mrs. Pritchett added the categories.
Really?
She gasped, heaving with merriment.
Aren't we going too far? Onions, electric toasters, and toothbrushes,
Marcia said clearly.
Sulfur, pencils, tomatoes, and flour,
David chimed in, getting into the swing of it.
Herbs, automobiles, and plows,
Miss Rice shouted. Behind them, the Ford coupe quietly vanished. On the rolling hills and slopes of Big Sur Park, the vegetation thinned.
Sidewalks,
Hamilton suggested.
Drinking fountains and clocks,
Marcia added.
Furniture polish,
David screamed, dancing up and down.
Hairbrushes,
Miss Rice said.
Comic books, McFife mentioned, and that gooey pastry with all the writing on it, that French stuff.
Chairs, Hamilton said suddenly, dazed by his daring.
And couches.
Couches are immoral,
Miss Rice agreed, stepping on the thermos bottle in her excitement.
Away with them, and glass, everything glass.
Obligingly, Mrs. Pritchett abolished her spectacles and all related items throughout the universe.
Metal,
Hamilton cried in a weak, astonished voice. The zipper of his trousers disappeared. What was left of the thermos bottle, a metal husk, vanished. Marcia's tiny wristwatch, the fillings in their teeth, the staves and hooks of the women's underclothing, ceased to be. In a frenzy, David scampered off, screaming,
"Clothes!"
Instantly, they were all mother naked, but it scarcely mattered. Sex had long ago disappeared.
Vegetation,
Marcia said, scrambling up to stand fearfully beside her husband. This time, the change was startling. The hills, the vast expanse of mountain, became as bald as a slab of stone. Nothing remained but the brown earth of autumn, baking under the cold, pale sun.
Clouds,
Miss Rice said, face twitching. The few puffs of delicate white that drifted overhead were gone.
And haze.
Instantly, the sun blazed furiously.
Oceans,
Hamilton said. The pastel green expanse winked out abruptly. All that remained was an incredibly deep pit of dry sand that extended as far as the eye could see. Appalled, he hesitated for an instant, giving Miss Rice time to cry,
"Sand!"
The titanic pit deepened. The bottom was lost from sight. A low, ominous rumble shook the ground under them. The basic balance of the earth had been shifted.
"Hurry!"
Miss Rice panted, her face distorted with passion.
"What next? What's left?"
"Cities,"
David suggested. Impatiently, Hamilton waved him aside.
Gullies! He bellowed. At once, they were standing on a uniform plane. All depressions had been ironed out. Six naked, pale figures of assorted weights and shapes. They stood gazing fervently around them.
All animals but man!
Miss Rice gasped breathlessly. It was done.
All life forms but man!
Hamilton topped her.
Acids!
Miss Rice shouted, and instantly sank down to her knees, face contorted with pain. All of them writhed in an ecstasy of discomfort. Basic body chemistry had been radically altered.
Certain metallic salts!
Hamilton screamed. Again they were convulsed by internal agony.
Specific nitrates!
Miss Rice added shrilly.
Phosphorus! Sodium chloride! Iodine! Calcium!
Miss Rice sank semi-conscious onto her elbows. All of them lay strewn about in postures of helpless suffering. The bloated, palpitating body of Edith Pritchett wriggled in spasms. Saliva dribbled from her slack lips as she fought to concentrate on the enumerated categories.
Helium!
Hamilton croaked.
Carbon dioxide!
Miss Rice whispered faintly.
Neon!
Hamilton managed. Everything around him wavered and faded. He was spinning in a chaos of infinite, gloomy darkness.
Freon! Gleon! Hydrogen!
Miss Rice's pale lips formed, swimming in the shadows close by.
Nitrogen!
Hamilton summoned as the swirl of non-being closed around him. In a last feeble burst of energy, Miss Rice raised herself up and quavered,
"Air!"
The world's layer of atmosphere swept out of existence. His lungs totally empty, Hamilton descended into a crashing blur of death. As the universe ebbed away, he saw the inert form of Edith Pritchett roll over in a reflexive spasm. Her consciousness and personality had fled. They had won. Her grip on them was gone. They had put an end to her. They were finally, agonizingly free. He lived. He lay outstretched, too drained of energy to stir, his chest rising and falling, his fingers clutching at the ground. But where the hell was he? With tremendous effort, he managed to open his eyes. He was not in Mrs. Pritchett's world. Around him, the dull pulse of darkness pounded and throbbed. An ugly undercurrent that drifted and swelled and pressed ominously against him. But dimly, he could make out other shapes, other bodies sprawled here and there. Marcia, inert and silent, lay not far off. Beyond her lay the hulk of Charlie McFife, mouth open, eyes glazed. And vaguely, in the swirl of drifting gloom, he could identify Arthur Sylvester, David Pritchett, the limp form of Bill Laws, and the vast, clumsy shape of Edith Pritchett, still unconscious. Were they back in the Bevatron? A brief, thrilling flicker of joy touched him, and then it slipped away. No, this was not the Bevatron. In his throat, a slow, bubbling wail formed, forcing its way up and out of his mouth. Desperately, feebly, he struggled to creep away from the thing that loomed over him, the slender, bone-like shell of life that gradually crumpled into itself until it was bending down close to him. In his ear, its dry, plucking whisper began. Vibrating dully, the sound drummed and echoed at him, coming again and again, until he had stopped trying to scream it down, had stopped his futile effort to push it away.
Thank you.
It breathed metallically.
You did your part very well. It happened just as I planned.
Get away! He shrieked.
I'll get away,
the voice promised.
I want you to get up and go about your business. I want to watch you. All of you are very interesting. I've been watching you a long time, but not the way I want. I want to watch you close up. I want to watch you every minute. I want to see everything you do. I want to be around you, right inside you, where I can get at you when I need to. I want to be able to touch you. I want to be able to make you do things. I want to see how you react. I want.
Now he knew where he was. He knew whose world they were in. He recognized the calm, metallic whisper that beat relentlessly into his ears and brain. It was the voice of Joan Rice.